can see Pastor Nick is away this evening, and we're going to continue where we left off last week.
Getting my road work.
And at the top of your sheet, I left the link where you can find the other classes if you've missed any, just as a reminder. And so last week we left off hearing about the genealogy of Esau, or Edom, depending on who you talk to, and how he married into the Canaanites and into Ishmael. And Pastor Nick spoke about the symbolic significance of Edom, and then he went a little ways into the prophetic destiny of Edom, the place, not the man. And he also spoke about the way Edom was governed and how Esau himself was impulsive and disorderly in the way he ran things in his own nation. And as we begin to enter chapter 37, Moses begins to introduce us to Joseph. And since I think everyone knows his story, I don't need to give you a spoiler alert on what I'm going to tell you, but there's really three ways to look at his story. And the first is just as a story, as literature, right? A loving father, a spoiled son, jealous brothers, a crafty wife, and an international famine. And as Pastor Nick would say, all exciting and drama to make a great movie. Right? And we can look at Joseph's story also as with profound theological implications. You know, we see the hand of God at work in Joseph's life, but unlike the previous instances, we don't necessarily see a lot of supernatural events occurring, and God is kind of working behind the scenes. And then we'll also see Joseph as an illustration of Jesus, loved by and obedient to his father, hated and rejected by his brothers, falsely accused, unjustly punished, and finally elevated to a powerful throne and saving people from death. Big difference, of course, being that Joseph didn't die, as we know, but Jesus did for us. So here we go. So starting in verse 1, now Jacob dwelt in the land where his father was a stranger, in the land of Canaan. This is the history of Jacob. And when it says that, it's really saying this is kind of the end of what we're going to talk about with Jacob, and now we're moving on. So Joseph, being 17 years old, was feeding the flock with his brothers, and the lad was with the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives, and Joseph brought a bad report of them to his father. Now Israel loved Joseph more than all his children because he was the son of his old age. Also, he made him a tunic of many colors, but when his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, they hated him and could not speak peaceably to him. And Moses makes it a point to note that he's with the brothers of Jacob's concubines, Bilhah and Zilpah, right, the secondary wives. And we already know how contentious things were between Rachel and Leah, so we can imagine that these secondary wives probably had a little friction going on of their own. And as we know, where the head goes, the body goes, right? So Jacob was already showing partiality to his wives, and so he started to follow suit with his sons as well. And most likely Joseph was out with his brothers to learn the family trade of being a shepherd, and being so much younger than the oldest, they probably resented having him tag along. We all know how that is when the kid brother or sister wants to tag along, and we don't want them there, and they get aggravated over it. And you could see that happening already. So then to make things worse, Joseph comes home, and he plays the tattletale, and he spills the beans on his brothers. And, you know, he's not responsible for what they do, and he has no authority over them, but he feels he needs to report on what they've been doing when they've been out in the field. And whatever infraction they committed was clear enough to Joseph that he felt he needed to report it to Daddy. And then, you know, which may show some little semblance of integrity, but we don't know. But since Moses kind of called it a bad report, we're not sure if it was bad because the brothers did something bad or just because Joseph was sort of exaggerating maybe some of the things the brothers had done. We don't know, and which would be more of a reason for his brothers to be angry at him. I mean, think about, you know, when your kids do that, they start out with one story, and then maybe they stretch it a little, maybe they add a few things. So we don't know exactly what they mean by a bad report, whether it's bad that the brothers did or bad that Joseph did or both. So that's an interesting thing, I thought, right there. And then to make things worse, you know, in spite of all this, Jacob's still showing favoritism to his favorite Joseph. And, you know, that's sort of a generational sin that's come down through the family line for years. Isaac loved Esau more than Jacob. Rebecca loved Jacob more than Esau. And Jacob loved Rachel and her children more than Leah and her children. So we see that being a big issue in this family, coming all the way down, and it hasn't stopped yet. And, you know, if anything, Jacob should have been a little more sensitive to this problem since he lived through it himself, but he's not paying attention. And then Moses mentions this tunic or this coat of many colors, and it was probably a sleeved coat. They said they described it probably coming to the wrist and then down to the ankles, and most men's tunics at that time had no sleeves, and they might have come below the knee or that length. So and the only other place that this term for a robe appears is in Samuel 13, where it's describing the garment of a king's daughter, and probably richly ornamented, very colorful, and not really the appropriate garb for a shepherd who's out in the field getting dirty and dusty all the time. And, you know, it's believed also that by giving Joseph this coat, he was letting all of his children know that this is going to be his chosen heir. Not a message that all these other sons wanted to hear. And verse 4 really sums it up. You know, his brothers couldn't stand him. They were very jealous and resentful. They didn't speak nicely to him. But consider also that Reuben had already disqualified himself by sleeping with Bilhah, right? And then Simeon and Levi had slaughtered the men in Shechem without being told to do that. And Jacob was probably also thinking that, you know, these are all the kids of Leah, and, you know, she was forced on me, and they're, you know, the concubines are just servants, so I'm not considering any of the children except Rachel's, who's my first love, to be considered the firstborn. And it's very possible that that's what he was thinking as he was, you know, looking at his kids and how he treated them. And if the brothers were looking at it that way and made to feel that way, then it was no surprise that they hated Joseph, because he was the apple of daddy's eye. And can you imagine you're Joseph, and, you know, how would you like that to be the opener of your life? And your brothers hated you. You know, not a very happy way to start out. And in reality, Jacob was the instigator of this strife, you know, with his gift of the coat, and this sort of started the little fire of Joseph's rejection at this point. You know, it was just enough to really get things started. And so now Joseph has his first dream, and if you see in verse 5, now Joseph had a dream, and he told it to his brothers, and they hated him even more. So he said to them, "Please hear this dream which I have dreamed. There we were, binding sheaves in the field. Then behold, my sheaf arose and also stood upright. And indeed, your sheaves stood all around and bowed down to my sheaf." And his brother said to him, "Shall you indeed reign over us? Or shall you indeed have dominion over us?" So they hated him even more for his dreams and for his words. Then he dreamed still another dream and told it to his brothers, and said, "Look, I have dreamed another dream, and this time the sun, the moon, and the 11 stars bowed down to me." So he told it to his father and his brothers. And his father rebuked him and said to him, "What is this dream that you have dreamed? Shall your mother and I and your brothers indeed come down, bow down to the earth before you?" And his brothers envied him, but his father kept the matter in his mind. You know, Joseph can't help himself. He gets this dream, and he has to tell his brothers about it. And I don't know if anyone's ever had a dream from the Lord, but sometimes you get some that you just can't keep to yourself. but also, you know, having been pampered for so many years as the favorite child, and in his naivety, you know, he probably expects this to be well received. You know, oh, I got this from God or whatever. And, you know, and the brothers are thinking, who does this little twerp think he is? How much more arrogant, self-centered, and egocentric can he get? And the dream is clearly referring to the brothers bowing or submitting to Joseph. And, you know, the word in there, when it says to bow, it means to bow completely to the ground, you know, which is bowing pretty low. And that's really showing the other person's authority and being submissive. And, you know, the question, his idea of ruling over and dominating them, and as a result, we see that their hatred increases all the more. You know, if they weren't angry before, they're really angry now. And then Joseph has his second dream, and he tells it again to his brothers, and he probably got the same response, if not a worse one. But we don't know because it doesn't mention that. So then he decides to tell it to the rest of the family. And this time his dream involves the whole family bowing down to him. And he's rebuked by his father immediately for suggesting that the whole family, especially that he and his wife, would bow to him. And Joseph's brothers were even more enraged. But Jacob chose to file this dream away in his mind. So clearly he thinks there's some kind of significance to it, but he doesn't know what it is, and he doesn't say anything about it. So what's really happening here? You know, I mentioned earlier that you don't see a lot of supernatural things happening in Joseph's story, but clearly the hand of God was orchestrating something in Joseph's life. He's giving him these dreams. He's working behind the scenes, and nowhere does he mention, you know, God gave me a dream, or God appeared to me in a dream, or God spoke to me in a dream, or any of those things that we've seen in the past, or God appeared to me, period. You know, we don't see any of that, you know, but we do see God's fingerprints all over this, because clearly Joseph has a destiny. We just don't know at this point what it is yet. And it's very likely that Joseph's brothers, you think about it, you know, as they're hearing these dreams, are already plotting in their minds what they're going to do with this little brother of theirs, you know, because they're angry. And how many times when you're angry at your sibling, oh, if I could just get rid of them, make them go away, you know, and I'm sure they're thinking those things, you know, even before we see anything happening. So, you know, we got to get rid of this nuisance brother of ours. So then in verse 12, then his brothers went to feed their father's flock in Shechem. And Israel, or Jacob, said to Joseph, are not your brothers feeding the flock in Shechem? Come, I will send you to them. So he said to him, here I am. Then he said to him, please go and see if it is well with your brothers and well with the flocks, and bring back word to me. So he sent him out of the valley of Hebron, and he went to Shechem. Now a certain man found him, and there he was, wandering in the field. And the man asked him, saying, what are you seeking? So he said, I am seeking my brothers. Please tell me where they are feeding their flocks. And the man said, they have departed from here, for I heard them say, let us go down to Dothan. So Joseph went after his brothers and found them in Dothan. So Jacob sends Joseph to check on his older brothers and their herds, but I think it's very interesting, this whole scenario. Because first of all, Hebron is 20 miles south of Jerusalem, and Shechem is 30 miles north of Jerusalem. So Jacob's sending him on a 50-mile journey by himself, or at least that's, you know, they don't say he's being sent with anyone else, which is a 3 to 5 day journey all alone. And also consider that Simon and Levi have a pretty bloody history with Shechem. All right, they went in and they killed all the men there, and then they captured all the women and children, and they took everything from the city. And yet, they're running their sheep all the way, or their goats, all the way up 50 miles away to the city. So it's a little suspect to me, personally. You know, I'm thinking to myself, why would they go that far? And the only reason I could think of possibly would be either they're doing dealings with some of the cities up there, Or maybe the drought is starting and they have to go further for grazing land. But we don't know. We don't know what's happening. But those are a couple of possibilities. I'm sure there are more. And then, you know, why would Jacob send Joseph by himself, first of all, and then wearing this coat, second of all? I mean, that's like wearing a bullseye on your back, if you think about it. You know, not only did his brothers hate him for wearing the coat, which maybe Jacob didn't know about, maybe they kept it to themselves that they were all annoyed about this coat, but we don't know that. But, you know, when you're wearing, that would be like me putting an orange and pink and purple neon coat on and walking around here, you know, walking 50 miles. So you're walking through all kinds of territory that you're not necessarily familiar with, you know, standing out like a sore thumb. And, you know, that's, to me, that's pretty wacky. So, and here's Joseph, okay, maybe he doesn't know how angry his brothers are about this coat, but he's so proud of it, probably. Oh, you know, this gives me status and makes me stand out, and my daddy loves me, so I'm going to wear it. And then he goes into this, you know, 5-day journey, 50-mile journey, to find his brothers. And then he arrives at Shechem, and he wanders around looking for them. And, you know, that shows us really how completely vulnerable this kid was. You know, he gets there, he doesn't find them, he doesn't know where to look, he doesn't know what to do, and, you know, it's possible that he doesn't know anywhere that they might have gone otherwise, and that's where their father thinks that they are as well. You know, because their father said, they're in Shechem, go and meet them there. So that was interesting to me as well. And then a man finds Joseph wandering around. So, okay, he's wandering around in this big area, and somehow he manages to bump into a guy that knows where his brothers are. What are the chances of that? What are the chances that you're in the grazing lands of Shechem and somehow you run into a guy that overheard your brothers talking about where they were going in Dothan? So if that isn't the hand of God right there, directing him somehow, I'm not sure what else is, because it seems pretty impossible to me that he could have found out any other way. Well, that he found, exactly, exactly. So, it's interesting that that would happen. You know, without God, I can't imagine that happening at all. So then in verse 18, now when they saw him afar off, even before he came near them, they conspired against him to kill him. Then they said to one another, look, this dreamer is coming. Come, therefore, let us now kill him and cast him into some pit, and we shall say, some wild beast has devoured him. We shall see what will become of his dreams. But Reuben heard it, and he delivered him out of their hands and said, let us not kill him. And Reuben said to them, shed no blood, but cast him into this pit, which is in the wilderness, and do not lay a hand on him, that he might deliver him out of their hands and bring him back to his father. So it came to pass, when Joseph had come to his brothers, that they stripped Joseph of his tunic, the tunic of many colors that was on him. Then he took him and cast him into a pit, and the pit was empty. There was no water in it. So here are the brothers. They see him. They can't miss him, right? They see that those colors of that coat, they recognize how he walks, and right away they're like, oh boy, here he comes. What are we going to do? So they're plotting and they're planning, and of course their first thought is murder. Nice bunch of brothers that they are. And, you know, they're already starting to make up the story. Well, we'll just tell our father that, you know, wild animals got him and killed him. And one author of a preacher's manual wrote this, envy is the most precious daughter of the devil because it follows his footsteps by hindering good and promoting evil. And he should have added something about her sister Malice, since they work together, because envy causes inward pain when seeing others succeed, and malice produces inward satisfaction when seeing others fail. And it's really what you see happening here. You know, they're so jealous of this 17-year-old kid and the fact that he's got the favor of his father that they're already plotting to kill him. That's frightening to me. I can't imagine that. And we see Reuben, you know, who doesn't need... He's already on his father's bad side for sleeping with his concubine. And so he sort of stands up for Joseph and asks for his life to be spared. And he's probably thinking, well, I don't need any more stress. If Dad finds out that I did this too and that I killed my brother, it's all over for me, which it's already all over for him. But, you know, he's thinking that way as well. And when you've got a wealthy father, people think that way. And they're, well, I can get out of that somehow, you know, even though, dot, dot, dot. So, you know, he's looking at it that way. So what happens? The brothers strip Joseph of his coat, and there's no mention of a struggle, but it's most likely that he fought for his life for that coat because it meant so much to him, and it meant a lot to his father. And, you know, if these men were angry enough to kill their brother, certainly fighting him for a coat wasn't going to stop them from really beating him up. It doesn't mention that, but then they, fling him into the cistern, and I'm sure he landed with a pretty hard thud when he got to the bottom, and we just don't know. One commentary mentioned that they thought they might have even taken all his clothes and just really went crazy over him, but we don't know. But either way, you know, how bad is that to throw your... And cisterns of those days were very narrow and tall. And they would a lot of times put prisoners in there, and that you can't climb out of those without a rope. So that's and help. You know, even just a rope probably wouldn't be enough because you'd never get the leverage you needed to get yourself out of there. So he was obviously in a pickle at that time. And in verse 25 it says, And they sat down to eat a meal. Then they lifted their eyes and looked, and there was a company of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead with their camels, bearing spices, balm, and myrrh, on their way to carry them down to Egypt. So Judah said to his brothers, "What profit is there if we kill our brother and conceal his blood? Come and let us sell him to the Ishmaelites. And let not our hand be upon him, for he is our brother and our flesh." And his brother listened. Then Midianite traders passed by, so the brothers pulled Joseph up and lifted him out of the pit and sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver. And they took Joseph to Egypt. So here's the callousness of these brothers. They sit down to eat a meal and completely ignored Joseph, who's over in this cistern screaming his head off, probably, and begging for mercy. And they're probably sitting, enjoying a nice meal, laughing, and doing what they would normally do as they're keeping their herds. And, you know, you can see that their hearts were hardened towards their younger brother by the years of envy and jealousy. And figure it's been 17 years, and you know, Jacob's been doting on this child ever since he was born because Rachel is his mother. And so he's the golden child in the family, really. And they're just going at it and going at it and going at it. You know, think and 17 years worth of anger and jealousy and resentment is a lot of years. And so they had plenty of time for that volcano to build its way up till now we see it exploding. And it's amazing. And so then the brothers see these merchants passing by, and Judah comes up with the harebrained scheme of selling Joseph as a slave, which shows in a way that he's not as bloodthirsty as some of his brothers. Maybe he didn't really want his brother to die, but they just didn't know what else to do with him, and now they have this opportunity to sell him off as a slave, which is sort of a redemptive thing for Judah, I believe, because then things changed for his life a little bit later on. And I'm sure he didn't want blood on his hands, and yet they're all willing to sell him into slavery, not knowing what kind of future that could bring, because that could just as easily bring death as them doing it themselves. Because slavery in those days wasn't, you know, it was a hit or miss thing. You know, if you ended up with the wrong master, you could be dead the next day. So there was no promise of life just by selling him off. And of course, there's now the financial gain. Oh, well, they can get 20 shekels of silver, which happened to be the going rate for slaves, male slaves of his age.
What is a shekel?
A shekel.
I know it's a monetary value, but what exactly?
Yeah, I forget what the amount is. I'm not sure. I should have looked that up. But it's not a lot, I could tell you. By today's standards, I'm sure it's not a lot of money.
All right, thank you.
So, you know, so they decide that they're going to gain financially by selling off their brother. And I thought it was interesting, too, this Midianite traders, they're also referred to as Ishmaelites.
I'm sorry to interrupt. It's 26 cents.
26 cents? Okay. So shekels, 26 cents. Yeah. Yeah, so in those days, that probably might have seemed like a lot of money, but it's still, it's not a whole lot. He would have been worth more once he got to Egypt, because they would have paid more there for a...
Whoever came up with the answer, thank you.
Thanks, Pam. So here we have what's called the Midianites, and they're also referred to as the Ishmaelites, and that's really a nod to the rivalry and strife between siblings. Again, because you've got that whole story that we're still dealing with today of Ishmael. So then in verse 29, then Reuben returned to the pit, and indeed Joseph was not in the pit. He tore his clothes and returned to his brothers and said, "The lad is no more, and I, where shall I go?" So they took Joseph's tunic, killed a kid of the goats, and dipped the tunic in the blood. Then they sent the tunic of many colors, and they brought it to their father and said, "We have found this. Do you know whether it is your son's tunic or not?" And he recognized it at once and said, "It is my son's tunic. A wild beast has devoured him. Without doubt, Joseph is torn to pieces." Then Jacob tore his clothes, put sackcloth on his waist, and mourned for his son many days. And all his sons and all his daughters arose to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted. And he said, "For I shall go down into the grave to my son in mourning." Thus his father wept for him. Now the Midianites had sold him in Egypt to Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh and captain of the guard. So we see here, Reuben wasn't around when they decided that the brothers wanted to kill him, and then Reuben isn't around again when they sell him as a slave, which I thought was strange, but we don't know where he was, we don't know what he was doing, but clearly he was grieved when he came back and found his brother gone, because he tore his clothes and he started mourning his death. And, you know, I think that's pretty significant. And you notice that the brothers aren't fessing up to what they did. They haven't said anything to him. They haven't given him any indication. You know, they could have turned around and said, "Oh, we sold him." But they didn't say anything. So for all Reuben knows, his brother's dead. And, you know, which kind of is a good thing on his part, because, you know, he has no knowledge of what really happened. But it's also possible, and it sort of indicates it in the text, that, you know, I think Reuben's plan was throw him in the pit, and then later on I'm going to come back, I'm going to get him out, and I'm going to take him home. But by the time Reuben got back, it was too late, and his brothers had already, you know, done the dirty deed. So.
But he would do that to redeem himself in the eyes of his father, right?
Probably.
And that's why he says, you know, "Where shall I go?"
Well, he's also thinking that now I'm going to get blamed for whatever happened to him, regardless of whether I was in on it or not. I think that's what he's thinking. That, okay, I don't know what happened to him, but I know what they were thinking at the beginning. I know they wanted to kill him. You know, maybe I wasn't around when the Midianites came through, so I didn't see any of that. But just because you weren't there doesn't mean you're not guilty of something, of not stopping them from what they were planning to do. So you're right about that. You know, he's trying to get himself off the hook, but it's really not going to get him off the hook. And then, of course, Jacob's reaction, the bloody coat, right, that Joseph and Pastor Nick mentioned it a couple of weeks ago. They took this bloody coat and they took a servant and they sent the coat home to their father without going themselves. And they knew, obviously, that their brother...
What was that?
It says in the text, I'll read it again. It says, they sent the tunic of many colors and they brought it to their father. They brought it to their father, which means the servants brought it to their father and said, we found this. Do you know whether it's your son's tunic? Because if they had brought the tunic themselves, they would have said, is this our brother's tunic? Is this Joseph's tunic, or is he here, and is the tunic still here, and what's happening? So clearly, they didn't even want to face their father when he found out what they'd done, even though he didn't know that they'd done it. And it's crazy to me. that they would even do that. And again, you know, they didn't say, we found Joseph's coat or we found my brother's coat. This is, we found this coat out in the land and it's all bloody. Is this your son's coat? And Jacob concluded, and he likes to jump to conclusions, Jacob concluded that his son had been mauled to death by some kind of wild animal. And, you know, so what does he do? He tears his clothes, he puts on sackcloth, and he begins to mourn, and which is the traditional thing that they did in those days. And then he insists that he's going to mourn for the rest of his life. And the tradition in those days was to mourn for about a week for a child. When Moses died, they mourned for about a month. And so... Jacob's saying, well, I'm gonna mourn for the rest of my life. And as far as we know, he probably did until later on when Joseph makes a reappearance. And, you know, he couldn't be comforted. And there's a really bitter irony here. Jacob's sons used Joseph's clothing, and he used the blood of a slain goat kid to deceive their father, right? And Jacob himself had used Esau's clothes and the skin of a slain goat to deceive his own father. So Jacob's deceit came full circle. He got himself what he did, in a way, to his own father, which, you know, you have to be careful what you do in your life, because you don't know what the repercussions of that are going to be. And, you know, we talked about the anger issue and the favoritism issues and all these generational things that run down the line of this family. And this is just another one of deceit. And, you know, God doesn't forget these things.
It hasn't really changed much over the years.
No, it hasn't. It really hasn't. I mean, people don't think about what they're doing. They don't realize that God is watching everything that they do, and they don't realize what the repercussions are going to be. But, you know, the word says you reap what you sow, and so you really have to be careful what you're sowing, because you don't want that to come back on yourself. So, and then, you know, finally, boy, I'm really running short tonight. Finally, we see that Joseph ends up in Egypt, and God has brought him safely there, and he's sold to one of Potiphar's chief officers. And Potiphar is called the captain of the guard, we'll find out in another chapter, suggesting that he was the head of Pharaoh's personal bodyguard. And so far, God hasn't reneged on his promises to watch over Joseph. But you can see he's sort of directing him in a particular place. He's got him in a place where he wants him to be. And we know that now because we've read the story and we know. But of course, you know, imagine what Joseph felt like when he arrived in Egypt. And, you know, these were all not good people. Let's put it that way. Because, you know, they didn't worship the same God. And they had different ideas and a different culture. And so, you know, here's Joseph. He's got to learn all over again what it is to live in this particular culture, you know, after having been with his father for 17 years and being taught by his father about, you know, the gods of Abraham and Isaac. And so now he's starting a whole new chapter in his life, which has got to be scary. And this is only the beginning of what we're going to see coming forward. And I'm sorry I ran so short. I thought I had more time on my pages. But does anyone have any questions about what we've...
The report that Joseph brought about his brothers,
uh-huh.
It says here, bad report. In the, and then if you look in the Orthodox Jewish Bible, it says a bad, evil report.
Mm-hmm.
So it starts with... Which kind of seems to suggest that he's maybe not telling the truth, right?
Right, which is why I said at the beginning that it's possible that he exaggerated, it's possible that he added a few things. You know, we don't know. We don't. Or it's also possible that his older brothers are so shady that they're doing dealings behind their father's back and making trades with people or doing something
right.
That you don't know. I mean, that's, you don't know what the object of that description is, whether
right.
It's something on one side or the other. But it's definitely
it's
not good.
True.
Exactly, exactly. But it's definitely not good, whatever it is.
Right.
So that's a good point.
But then it's interesting then, because then they're like, well, maybe Joseph is, you know, he's not innocent necessarily in this, but really then what you see is that it's an imperfect, and you look at the way his father loved him with the favoritism,
mm-hmm.
right? Again, it's like, so then you see an imperfect father with an imperfect love,
right?
And maybe an imperfect son, and then you say that sort of mirrors, like you said, the story of Jesus, where it's a perfect love,
right?
A perfect father who
right.
sends him to redeem us.
No, that's true. Because, you know, when you look at a lot of times at children who are really pampered and really, you know, I mean, they get away with a lot of things. And a lot of things get overlooked. You know, they get very spoiled. They have everything that they want. They can do anything they want. They can do no wrong. You know, and sometimes that's true of, you know, people. You see parents sometimes that none of their children can do wrong. It's they're my children. They can do no wrong. You know, and we don't know in this case. I mean, obviously, none of them were perfect.
Right.
But
it's a contrast.
But it's a complete contrast to Jesus, where he was, you know, the good child, and I mean, he had a great father, a good father. You know, I mean, God can't abide by sin.
Right.
Jesus couldn't abide by sin. So, yeah, it's a complete contrast of what we're seeing, but. Yeah, it's amazing to me what Joseph's life is going to bring. And, you know, think about those dreams, too. You know, how would you feel if your sibling came to you and said, well, you're going to serve me someday, you know, or parents, you're going to serve me. You know, I mean, that was, especially at that time, it's pretty unheard of to be talking back to your parents that way. You know, even if you saw it in a dream, you know, it's pretty impertinent to say something of that nature.
Do you think Joseph believed that those dreams were real, though? Did he know that at that time that was even a gift that he carried? Like interpreting or knowing that dream did come from God?
I don't think so, because there's no mention that he said God gave me that dream, or he might have been thinking it, but he never spoke it out. Whereas in the past, in Genesis, you've always heard someone say, God showed me, God gave me, God did, God, you know, was there, whatever it was, and or they knew it was the angel of the Lord or whatever it was. In this case, God's not even mentioned.
It wasn't until, like, further down the line that he realized that his dreams were messages.
Yes.
That they were happening.
Yes.
And that he could interpret more.
Mm-hmm. And I think that happens a lot with people in general. You know, when God gives you a gift, a spiritual gift of some kind, you know, it takes a while to unwrap that and to understand what it is that God's given you and how it works and how he wants to use you with that gift. So it's really a foreshadowing of that as well, because we don't know sometimes that we have certain gifts in us, and yet other people see them in activity and they say, oh, you have this gift or you have that gift, but you don't realize it yourself. You're not seeing it, and sometimes it takes someone outside of you to point it out to you and say, wow, how do you do that? You know, how is that working? And then you realize. Joe?
Yeah.
Yes.
And how they always wanted to plot to kill him, you know, and that was on their mind. You know, the religious, the Pharisees, the scribes, you know, all of the leaders of the nation of Israel were always constantly plotting to kill Jesus. And so, you know, it's to the detail how the Lord is giving us here a picture of what a future event. Say, look at Joseph, and this is what he went through, and that's what Jesus went through in his first coming,
mm-hmm.
how he was rejected by his own. You know, he says he came to his own, and his own received him not.
That's right.
And to the very detail about even the coat of many colors, right, which signified the belovedness of his father, and showing us that here is my beloved son,
mm-hmm.
I'm giving you. And you know, this is who he is. He's highly favored, because that tunic represents highly favored. This is my beloved, my highly favored son that I am giving to you, you know. And what do we do with it? What did the nation do with it? You know what I'm saying?
That's right.
And so even in the fact of the coat, because at the cross, you know, they what did they do with the coat? That
right.
that they cast lots.
Mm-hmm.
Pointed out in your research that they could have very well have stripped Joseph naked and put him in the pit, and Jesus was completely naked at the cross. So,
yeah.
I mean, the details that are in this, and I think we can only understand it in its magnitude when we see it as a picture of Jesus' first coming and, you know, his sufferings, and of course the latter part.
Yeah.
You know, of his second coming.
It's yet to come.
He does, you know, come to be second command. But that's another lesson.
That's right.
To add on to what you just said, in terms of Joseph's brother Reuben, who more or less said, I'm not having any of this, and Jesus, and the Lord Jesus Christ's instance, when he was handed over to Pontius Pilate, Pilate washed his hands of the whole thing,
that's
too.
Right.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, if you
that's
look...
True.
That's a good
it's
point.
All into its own. I don't believe I'm talking like
this.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's for the money. Right, and that
it's the price
there was an
of
exchange of money.
Yeah.
That's right.
There are so many similarities and parallels.
Yeah, there really are a lot. I mean, just the fact that he got the coat. Just the fact that he got the coat, which was really giving him the authority and the kingship. You know, because he became the heir, you know, just like Jesus is the heir and will take his throne at a particular time. It's the same thing. So, yeah, it's amazing.
Also, as we come to
to learn later, it's a major lesson in forgiveness, this whole story of Joseph and his brothers, you know, paralleling God's forgiveness.
Right. That's right.
Because he had no end last
year. That's right.
And how to forgive. Mm-hmm. Not just forgiving, it's how to forgive.
That's right.
That we'll learn.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot in the story.
Yeah. I think it's also interesting how before God could bless Joseph, he had to humble him in a way. The same way he had to humble Jacob in a way. In that, you know, sometimes when you're blessed, there's going to be that adversity that comes first, but and that kind of opens your hand so God could bless you.
Well, that's really the only way any of us can come to the Lord, though. We have to be humbled. We have to realize that we're just sinners. That we, of ourselves, can do nothing about it. And that we're helpless to do anything about it. Because if we don't realize that, if we don't admit that, that we're clearly, you know, we can't get rid of our sin nature no matter what we do. You know, we can never clear ourselves of our nature. Ever. And so the only way we can come to the Lord is by understanding that and realizing that and humbling ourselves before the Lord and saying, I can't do anything. Only by what your Son has done can I be cleansed of what's happened in my life. And you know, that's a huge picture that we're even seeing with this. You know, you go through your life and, you know, there are some things you think you can handle, you know, on your own. But in reality, it's only God that can really clean up your act no matter what you've done, no matter how perfect you think you've been. Even if you've never done anything wrong your whole life, that nature is still in you. And even the slightest little thought, you know, God sees all of that.
Yeah.
You know, if you think it with your mind, if you see it with your eyes, you know, even though subconsciously you don't even realize, it's over, game over. So, you know, only the Lord can redeem us from our sin nature.
I think Joseph was really in a pressure cooker. I read something about that. Like, we're all in a pressure cooker, you know, and everybody has their own timing mm-hmm. for when they're going to be used. And I think in Joseph's case, it shows that timing. It shows that. What's hopeful from the story that I read that in the book is that most of the people in the Bible, things didn't happen to them in their 20s or, you know, great things.
Mm-hmm.
It happened when they were in their 40s, their 50s, you know? And sometimes we come to an age where we feel hopeless because we are at an age where we feel like we have less time or less of a chance to be used mm-hmm. and to be glorified in a way that we feel like we put in all this, you know? I mean, I came into my Christian walk late. But my faith started happening a while ago.
Right.
So that was my process. That was my, I'm still in the pressure cooker. You know, the timer hasn't gone off, but I feel myself getting closer to that point where I'm finally going to be, I'm still being used, but I'm going to see what I'm really being used for. Mm. The purpose, the whole big, you know, like the confetti that's going to come out of all this is going to finally come to light.
Yeah. And we, you know, I think sometimes, or a lot of times, we jump from one boiling pot to another. It's not like we get out of the pot and suddenly life is grand and everything goes smoothly. You know, it's the hills and valleys of life. But each time we make it through one of those valleys, God can use that because we've made our way through. We've learned things from what we've been through. We've changed. You know, even God has changed our mind in a lot of instances. You know, you could be in a bad situation where you're having difficulty with a relationship, you know, at work or at home, whatever it is, and God teaches you how to deal with that. You know, so that the next time you run into that, you know what to do. Because, you know, the Lord won't let you out of that situation until you learn what he's trying to teach you. And I've been through that, I could tell you, years and years and years for some things and short times for other things. But that's how God works in us. You know, because the whole point is to build up our faith, first of all, because without faith we can't please God in anything that we do. and also to show us that when our faith is in the one who loves us and cares for us and is for us and not against us, we can move forward into the next thing, knowing that even if we end up in a pot of boiling water, he's going to take us through it and out the other side, and we don't have to fear that we're going to get stuck there. I mean, yes, there are certain times when God uses a long period of time and keeps you in that pressure cooker for a long time, but there's a plan and a purpose for all of it. And a lot of times you don't see what that is until you're way past the other side. And even a few years later, you look back and you're like, wow, he was doing this in me. He was doing this in me. He was building up my faith. He was building up my knowledge of the word. He was building up my worship. He was doing all these things and really trying me to find out, you know, like they say about tea bags, you don't know what's in a tea bag till you put it into hot water. And it's true. What comes out when you get into that pressure situation? You know, is it something that's going to please God? Is it something that's not pleasing God? And then, you know, God's going to keep you in there until you're just right, until the tea has steeped to the point where it's got the right flavor and the right character and the right aroma and all of those different things. And he does that with us as well, because he wants us to be the best that we can possibly be. And, you know, sometimes we go around those mountains a few extra times because we just don't get it the first time. Or maybe there's just something else that we need to learn, because sometimes there's more than one thing that he's trying to show us and teach us. And is it tough? Yeah, it's tough. But at the same time, you know, we've got him holding our hand and leading us through. You know, I've been in situations personally where, you know, I thought things were going to never end. You know, I see this tunnel that I'm in, but, you know, you see that light at the end of the tunnel, and the Lord specifically said to me, I am the light at the end of the tunnel. I'm waiting for you to get through here, to meet me on the other side. And it's true. And once you realize that you're not just floundering around, and once you become obedient, because that's another big thing, you know, he wants us to be obedient to what he's asking us to do. And if we don't listen, if we're not listening for his voice telling us what to do, or if we're hearing him and not doing what he's asking us to do because we're procrastinating or stubborn or whatever it is, you know, I'm talking about myself, but, you know, he's going to wait. He's got plenty of patience. He's got all the patience in the world. So it takes a while, but once, you know, once you realize what it is he wants from you, he moves you to the next level.
You know, about 4 years ago when my darling wife died, I was in a real, really bad place. I cursed the Lord. I didn't want any part of him. And about 6 months ago, I came to his house up there on King Street. Mm-hmm. And I heard his voice. And he said, this is where you're supposed to be. Mm-hmm. In this past 6 months, I like myself now. I'm at peace with myself.
Wow.
And nothing's ever going to stop me from being by his side.
That's fantastic.
And I'm the way I've been compared to what I used to be, the way I am now, the old me is dead.
Yeah.
The new me is here now. And my good day, my best days are still ahead of me.
Oh, absolutely. Amen. You know, because he wants us to know who he sees us as. You know, a lot of people don't realize, and he's been talking to me about that a lot lately. There's a book in the making somewhere there. But about our identity, about who we are in Christ and what that means. Because if we understood the way the first century apostles understood who they are in Christ, we'd be doing the same things that they did and greater. I really believe that. But, you know, our identity is so tied up in our past a lot of times that we can't always see the future until God starts clearing all that out and going through those tunnels and those valleys and into those pressure cookers are the things that help God to show us.
Right.
What,
just speaking of identity, I was just really not struck, but just I thought it was curious that we're still referring to Jacob as Jacob. So I just think that's interesting in light of what you're saying and identity. And Saul became Paul, and from there on out, he was Paul. So I don't know if you have any insight.
insight as to why that is.
I think it's just part of our growth that we have to do. You know, Jacob isn't a young man. And so all of a sudden everyone's starting to call him something else. I can relate to that a little bit because my name is Susan, but everyone calls me Sue. But I was at a prayer meeting with some friends, and they looked at me and they said, "The Lord calls you Susan." And so I started calling myself Susan, and then people would call me Susan and I wouldn't turn around because I was expecting them to call me Sue. And it takes time, I think, to move into that place where the Lord, when he changes your name, brings you. And plus the people around you. I mean, obviously he didn't change my name that much. He just asked me to use my full name instead of my nickname. My one friend calls me Susie Susan. So, I mean, and that's how she writes emails to me. But, you know, to step into that identity is work for us. And it's a change for us. And I think we need to make that shift, but it doesn't always happen immediately. So that's a good point. Yeah, because I'm sure Paul had an issue with that as well. You know, because he went from being this persecuting man to a lover of the Lord, and no one wanted to talk to him after that. Wait a minute, you're still that guy that, you know, was killing people and, you know, holding the coats in the corner, watching everyone get slaughtered and all of those things. And so it takes time, not only for us, but even for the people around us to see that change and to see that shift. And consider, you know, a lot of people when they get saved. You know, I was this yesterday, but now I'm under the grace and mercy of the Lord today. Does that mean I've changed 100%? No. But people are always going to see me, and people who don't know the Lord are always going to see me as the old person, because that's who they knew. That's who they were familiar with. You know, that's who knew my mistakes and knew the things that I, you know, did wrong. And, well, why aren't you perfect now? Because you're a Christian. Now why aren't you perfect? But it's the same thing. It's a process and it's a maturation where the Lord is growing us up in him to become, you know, who he sees us as. But it's not necessarily an overnight thing. I mean, yes, do people get saved and, you know, their addictions stop? And yes, sometimes that happens, but not every time. You know, there are certain things that we still hold on to that we need to give up ourselves. And I think part of that, you know, the Lord says, you know, work out your salvation with fear and trembling. And what does that mean? It means we've got to do our part. It's not just the Lord saves us and he does it all. And suddenly we're instantly changed into these perfect people. No, you know, that doesn't happen. And look at Peter, he denied the Lord 3 times. And the Lord had to redeem that by making him say, "I love you" 3 times. I mean, because 3 times in that time period meant that's it, you're done. And so the fact that the Lord did that, it amazed me, you know, but it was necessary for him to do that, because once you make a vow like that, the only way to break that. He did.
He already knew who,
because he knows the end from the beginning. He sees who we are. He knows who we are. He sees the person that he wants us to become. But it's hard for us sometimes to see that. That's why I'm saying identity is so much of a problem, because we just don't understand sometimes. There are so many words in the Bible that tell us, you know, you're more than a conqueror, you're a mighty woman of valor, you're all these different things, you know, but do we believe that? Is that how are we living our life in a victorious manner that says, "I believe who God says I am"? And that's really important. And I'm not sure we get it yet, a lot of us.
I like how Jesus says, "Be holy, if I am holy." Mm-hmm. And I strive for that, because Daniel did it, Joseph did it, and they were young. So we can really be like that if we're conscious of the Holy Spirit and every day walk like this.
there's a bird on your shoulder, someone mm-hmm. said. So when you walk very slowly and cautiously, because if you don't, it'll fly away. So if you take that and you walk like that, you can be. We don't have to say, well, yeah, we are sinners. We are. But we can be different, and we can be close to the Lord. And someone could say, you are different. And so I really mm-hmm. strive for that, to be hopeful.
Yeah, and I mean, we're all called to do that, for sure. Yeah. And I like that with the bird, to walk slowly, because you don't want to scare it away.
Yep.
But yeah, it's important. It's important that we pay attention, and there's nothing stopping us but ourselves. You know, I'm my worst enemy when it comes to certain things, because, you know, I put limits on myself. We're human; we put limitations on ourselves. But, you know, there's really no reason to do that. So, boy, we came a long way from Joseph. But it's just a good way. Any more questions? Comments?
Thank you.
Thank you. You have to unlock it so you can turn it off.
How do I get it to you?
Just unlock it.
Get home safe.
And then it stopped.